I'm going to give an overview of Camden and her career. Because I forgot to start the recording right away and had to do it in the middle of introducing Camden Morganti. So Camden Morganti is a licensed psychologist with a doctor of psychology. She has nearly 15 years of experience as a therapist and college professor. She owns a private therapy practice focusing on women's issues, relationships, sexuality, trauma, and spirituality, and is a frequent speaker. Dr. Camden's mission is to help Christians heal their faith from toxic beliefs. She is the author of Recovering from Purity Culture. Dr. Camden lives in Knoxville, Tennessee, with her husband and their daughter and son. And I've been lucky enough to get to know Camden a little bit personally. We've had a couple conversations over Zoom, and we spoke before Thursday's gathering, and I took her back to Grand Rapids on Friday morning, and this is just a genuinely good, kind, caring person, and she really is worthy of the attention she gets, and I'm grateful that she came and shared her wisdom at Still Processing.
A lot of us here are in a lot of different places with religion, with politics, and all kinds of things, right? I don't call myself a Christian. I can't imagine that I ever will again. But that's me. That could change. I don't know. So you are welcome wherever you are. Atheist, agnostic, Christian, Buddhist, it doesn't matter to us at all. I have all these things that I want to say before we start, but I'm going to just do one of them because we don't have time for a bunch of different things. I want to make sure we get into your work. That's why we're here. But there was something that happened yesterday that caught my attention. And I just happened to catch this clip from this person who you probably, I don't know, as you look up on the screen, does that look like somebody you're familiar with? Probably not. And that's actually better to a certain degree. Her name is Representative Melanie Stansbury. She is from New Mexico. She's a member of the House Oversight Committee. She's a Democrat. And she met with the Epstein victims, along with other members of Congress. And she came out and said this. And I think it's worth hearing what she had to say.
But before I turn to the substance of the case itself, I want to say to anyone out there who is currently experiencing abuse of any kind, we see you. We are here fighting for you, and we will fight for justice for every person who is experiencing sexual violence in this country, and that is what this case is actually about. But I want to be clear that what we heard today is a cover-up. And it is a cover-up of epic proportions, a cover-up involving the United States government, the justice system, rich and powerful individuals, a cover-up potentially involving foreign countries and foreign actors. And yes, here today in this House, as our colleagues are up in the House chamber in the Rules Committee, a cover-up by the Republicans in this chamber. Because as you will find out in the coming days and weeks, this goes all the way to the top. So let's be clear about that. There has been a systemic failure of the justice system for decades, a systemic failure to hold people who are powerful and have money to account, and that has allowed not just hundreds, but potentially thousands of women, not only in the United States, but around the world, to be bought, sold, and trafficked for sex, not only by Jeffrey Epstein, but by his associates and his rich and powerful friends. So that is why we subpoenaed these records. That is why these victims were here today to bravely tell their stories. And whatever justice looks like in the coming days and weeks and years, we will follow every thread. We will follow every piece of evidence. We will follow every bank record. We will follow every investigation. We will follow every court order. And we will make sure that those who were abused by these men are held accountable.
That's the kind of energy I'm looking for from our politicians right now. And I love that it's coming from somebody most of us have never heard of. And I also want to say, like, I can hear, having spoken publicly and knowing what it feels like to be nervous and to have that reflected in your voice, right? Which there were times that part of it, there was audio that was bad from C-SPAN, but there, you could tell, like, she was scared, but she did it anyways, right? She said what was true and was right, even though she was scared. And I think that's more inspiring than the person whose voice doesn't crack, right? Because a lot of us feel very similarly, but we're afraid our voice is going to crack when it matters. Who cares? Let it crack. It doesn't matter, right? And obviously, this story is not unrelated to what we're going to talk about here today. Not completely, right? I would imagine Camden would say the same thing. This is another example of men and patriarchy deciding that women are kind of disposable. We can do with them what we want, right? And this is happening in the upper echelons of our government right now. People like that have power. And we need to be able to say that that is sick and wrong, right? We need to say that. Sometimes just we need to be together and say that together to one another and not our heads or whatever it is we feel like doing. I'm scared about what's happening in our country. I'm angry. I mean, I am as pissed off as I have ever been in my whole life. Really. But I'm also a little bit scared because I don't know where this all leads. I don't know what's going to be asked of me. Of any of us, truly. Okay, that's enough of that. I want to start with Camden. Again, I'm just working on saying Camden and not Morgan. A little bit of her story, a little background of her story, and sort of how did we get here, where you are writing a book on recovering from purity culture. So this is a little clip from her book. This is her voice. Right? I do this sometimes where we play something from the book and the person who's here has to listen to their own voice. It's okay. It's beautiful. You did a great job. Okay, so here's some background and then we'll unpack this.
Still, I recognize that for so many in this Christian space, there is much fear surrounding the deconstruction of any part of our faith. One writer warns against faith deconstruction, stating that the type of faith you end up embracing almost never resembles the Christianity you formerly knew. To that I say, good, because I don't want the Christianity I formerly knew, the one that relied on spiritual platitudes, empty promises of sexual prosperity, black and white beliefs, and fear, judgment, and condemnation of anyone who looks or thinks differently. And I don't want that for you either. I am still a Christian. You may still identify as one too, but I have not finished deconstructing and reconstructing my faith. I have not arrived. Instead, if my faith looks different than it used to, and my beliefs have evolved from the legalism of my childhood, if I still maintain love for God and love for my neighbors, and if I am living in relationship with God, then I find peace in my faith journey. Perhaps instead of saying we have healed our faith, we can say we are living with a healing faith. Becoming a psychologist not only prompted my faith deconstruction, it also provided me with many tools to assist in the reconstruction of my faith and sexual ethic. Purity culture did not provide me with sex education, but my psychology classes and human sexuality and training in sex therapy did. Patriarchy did not empower me to use my voice, gifts, and strengths as an equal person in marriage and the church, but my research in feminist psychology and egalitarian theology did. And legalism did not give me the skills to ask hard questions, accept ambiguity, and find sources of truth, but my training in the integration of spirituality and therapy did. Not everyone has the opportunity or desire to pursue an education in psychology or even the resources to seek professional therapy. I see it as my mission to use the privilege of my education to pass on to others the skills and tools I've learned. This mission has propelled and sustained me in the writing of this book in order to help others uncover the harm done by purity culture and to finally find a path forward in their recovery.
So tell me a little bit You are someone who grew up in purity culture, so you are coming from the inside, not from the outside. And to get there, through significant faith change or a change in your faith. Tell us a little bit more about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so I grew up in purity culture. I'm a millennial, and purity culture really peaked in the 1990s to early 2000s when I was a teenager and growing up. That's when the kind of modern expression of purity culture as we know it was peaking, with I Kiss Dating Goodbye, with modesty ministries, you know, whole ministries just devoted to telling young girls what to wear. With the courtship culture of I Kiss Dating Goodbye, as I said. And so that's how I grew up as a evangelical Christian at the time. And I was a big proponent of it. I really bought into it, believed in it. I'm a firstborn daughter, so I'm like, I'm going to be, you know, a good girl and follow all the rules and do everything right. And then when I got my heart broken at 20 years old, you know, as a young person, and I realized that purity culture may not be all it's cracked up to be. And then I went and got my doctorate in psychology, as you heard, and became a therapist, and I started to see the negative effects of purity culture, as well as other forms of religious trauma in my clients, because working with clients really exposed me to things that I had just never experienced personally in a fairly privileged life. And so it really made me rethink my faith and rethink the legalism that I had grown up with and really been a proponent of myself. And so I went through a faith deconstruction period in my 20s. And when I first started writing about this, which was in about 2020, I started writing on social media and speaking on podcasts about purity culture and faith deconstruction. And I would say, you know, I deconstructed in my 20s. I'm post-deconstruction. And now, as you heard, I say, you know, I'm not done deconstructing and reconstructing my faiths, my beliefs, my politics, my values, everything. Like, it's really in process still. And so that's why we say recovering, not recovered, healing, not I'm healed. So it's definitely something still in process, but something that I felt like I've gained all this education and all these tools as a psychologist and all this experience with clients that I want to help others find healing too. I didn't see a lot of mental health professionals talking about this topic, and so I felt like that was something that I could bring and could bring to my book. So, yeah.
Were you told, or was there concern as you did advanced degrees in psychology by maybe loved ones who were in fundamentalism that, like, be careful in doing more study because it may affect your faith? Was that a concern people had for you?
Yeah, not really. I did attend a Christian college and a Christian grad school, which actually I think accelerated my deconstruction. Everybody I went to grad school with, we all went through this, you know, big period of rethinking our beliefs, and some no longer identifying as Christian, some, you know, just still identifying as Christian, but ending up in their faith looking very different, which is how I find myself. So I think that actually made it worse, you know, going to a Christian college, but that didn't give, like, my parents or family concerns. But I definitely saw the dark side of religion too in my clients and in the things I was learning.
So the clients were kind of, their stories were the main impetus, or one of them that was sort of pushing you to look at the darker side of purity culture?
Yeah, I would say, clients. And I would also say when I took human sexuality in my doctoral program, you know, in other classes we learn about how great religion is. And there is a lot of research that shows that it can benefit people's, you know, mental health and well-being and give you community. But in that class we learned that religion was one of the predictors of developing a sexual pain disorder that makes sex impossible or very painful. It used to be called vaginismus. Now it's called genitopelvic pain disorder, but it's one that I now treat pretty regularly. And that shocked me as a young person, because all I had heard were the sexual prosperity gospel of purity culture, that as long as you wait, sex is going to be amazing and mind-blowing and pleasurable. And then I'm hearing in class, actually, being conservative and religious can cause sexual problems, not give you mind-blowing sex. And so that was really eye-opening. And then as a therapist, I started to see that in real life.
So I want to move to patriarchy, because this was something that you mentioned in the book, and you'll mention in this clip I have, that it's sort of like, in some ways, the foundational problem, the foundational ideology that kind of affects all the rest. And we did, in January of this year, we did a gathering on the trouble with boys and men, that boys and men are going through. It was hard to do because it felt like, what a weird time to feel bad for boys and men, which is how I still feel. It still feels strange to me to concern myself. But so we talked about patriarchy then from Bell Hooks's book. God, what's the name of that again? I wrote it down. The Will to Change, Men, Masculinity, and Love. Highly recommended to everyone. I just want to run through your definition and her definition, and I put in some filler from Bell Hooks' book as well and from yours, and then we'll talk about patriarchy.
Underlying all the toxic cultures is patriarchy. Patriarchy is the belief that men are superior to women and should rule over them as the leaders in the head. It's rooted in the idea that women are in need of protection and provision. Men make the decisions. Women are subordinate and submissive. Women are denied autonomy and agency unless men are acting on their behalf. What is the outcome of purity culture? It controls sexuality, particularly women's, through myths and false promises about premarital sex. With cultural changes such as birth control, the feminist movement, and higher rates of women in the workforce, women began having more freedom on their own and became less dependent on men as a result. But if you could indoctrinate women to believe their sexuality is dangerous, to believe they are responsible for men's sexual sin, that their virtue and desirability as partners is largely tied to their purity, and that their fathers need to control their dating choices, then you've developed another way to subdue and subordinate them, one that is so insidious it comes under the cover of benefit and protection for women, one that is sanctified by its similarity to the Christian virtue of chastity. Beliefs about gender roles exist on a spectrum from patriarchy to extreme feminism or matriarchy.
Patriarchy is a political social system that insists that males are inherently dominating, superior to everything and everyone deemed weak, especially females, and endowed with the right to dominate and rule over the weak and to maintain that dominance through various forms of psychological terrorism and violence.
I'm going to cut that one there just so we can move on to some other things. So I guess what I'm curious about is, when did patriarchy and the problem of patriarchy, which is like a pretty essential ideology and doctrine within fundamentalist Christianity and purity culture, right? So get to the place of being like, there is this system behind all this that is empowering men and letting them control women's sexual. Like, how did you get to that point, having been inside it, I guess?
Yeah, I think it is covert in some ways when you're in purity culture and when you're in evangelical Christianity, because it is just the water you swim in. But I was always a strong-willed child, as James Dobson called me, and just had, you know, that kind of take charge assertiveness as a firstborn, I guess. And so I never really gave into those traditional gender roles, you know, and I thought, like, that's dumb that women are only able to serve in children's ministry at the church. Like, you know, I just kind of always questioned those things. But then it was probably in college, again, I took a psychology of women class where I learned that being a Christian and a feminist didn't have to be, you know, opposites, like that you could be both. And I really embraced that identity and that belief system and went on to study it more in grad school. And as I was researching for the book, I just realized, you know, purity culture, it seemed on the outside like it could be a good thing. Like a lot of the authors of the movement made it seem like this is to help young people avoid the dangers of premarital sex at a young age, you know, and it's to help them see the spirituality and sacredness of sex from a Christian perspective. But yet it had this control aspect to it, you know. So I say my definition of purity culture is a socio-political political movement that attempted to persuade young people to avoid sex before marriage, using fear and shame as tools of control. So it wasn't just the belief, which seems, you know, benign or positive on at first glance. It was the shame and fear that was used to coerce and control, especially women, into abstinence. So, yeah, so I see patriarchy as underlying a lot of these toxic belief systems like modesty and courtship and rape culture and purity culture.
And we'll go through those things and get to them. I was reminded of this TikTok I saw the other day, and it was a young woman, and she said, "My friend said to me the other day that the new Trump administration feels like when the Kens took over in Barbie Land." And she was like, "And now I can't think of anything else. It's just too perfect." Okay. All right, I have a little mashup here that you're seeing the first part of it, okay? And it's not a joke. These people are for real.
It's hard to watch.
It's hard to watch. And then there's a second part that for some might be hard to watch. I'm guessing for this crowd, you're mostly going to like the second part. And then we'll unpack this and head into purity.
The top five things I will never do as a godly wife.
Number five, she will never undermine my authority in front of the children.
If I disagree, which is rare, we talk privately. In front of our kids, we are united front, always.
Number four, she never withholds sex to get her way.
Intimacy is a gift, not a bargaining chip. I will never use it as a weapon.
Number three, speak to me like I'm her child.
He is my covering and my protector, not someone to mother. My words will lift him up, not tear him down.
Number two, seek validation from other men.
My worth is found in Christ and my husband's love, not in attention from other men.
And number one, try to play the role of a leader.
God gave my husband the position of head of the home. That's not oppression, that's order. I don't try to take the wheel, I champion his leadership.
Christian husbands, if you want this to be a reality for you by becoming a high-level husband who is on fire, free, and followed, then comment blueprint below and I'll send you a resource to get you dialed in.
Most men, especially conservative men, have no idea who women really are. Over the past few months, we've all seen the videos of men testing the waters with, you know, like, maybe women shouldn't be able to vote. Maybe we should have a policy that requires all women to have at least one child. Those men don't believe those things are actually possible. It's a bluff, which isn't to say that they wouldn't choose to do those things if they could, but they know that they can't. They're saying them because they still believe in the version of women that patriarchy has sold them. The version where we are fearful and timid and meek and naturally submissive and compliant. So they think that if they keep turning up the rhetorical heat on us, that the direction that we're going to head of the two directions available is the direction of compliance and submission. These men have no idea who we are. You can see how perplexed they are that the louder they get, the further we go from them. You see them on the podcast saying, "Oh my gosh, they're projecting by 2030 that half of women over the age of 30 will be child-free and single." And then they make their like dying old and cat lady jokes, thinking that that's going to be the thing that makes us run back to them. They don't know any version of us that are not scared little girls. You know, the characters in the movies that are always turning to the man and saying, "What should we do?" They just haven't paid attention to us. They haven't watched the media that we have made. They haven't read the books that we have written. They haven't listened to the music that we create. They haven't followed female content creators because they don't perceive us as being capable of leadership. So they're stunned right now because our behavior isn't aligning with their version of what a woman is, because they haven't yet realized that we are stronger than them. So obvious to us. Just go watch a man and a woman get a tattoo. Watch a man and a woman traverse an extremely stressful period of their life and see who handles it with more resilience. Corporations with women on the board outperform corporations without. Countries led by women outperform countries led by men. Female surgeons have much better surgery outcomes than male surgeons. I could go on and on. And these men have propagandized themselves out of seeing the truth of who we are. But we see the truth of who they are. We've had to study them for our own safety and for our own validation, because we were told that it would only come via a man. So we learned them inside and out. We've watched their movies, we've read their books, and we've watched them lead. We know our enemy well, the enemy that is the conservative man. And they know less about us than they know about their family pet, which is often how they see us anyway. This is why matriarchy is inevitable, because we are unmatched.
Yeah, right? Celebrate it. It's true. This is true. I've often said we should take like the next 200 to 300... I shouldn't say often. I've recently said that we should take the next 200 to 300 years and only allow women to be leaders. Just, we should try it. You know? I think. So I am open to this matriarchy. I'm for it. But I'm also super, super pissed off at men and at the current administration. So I'm not coming from a place of health and objectivity. But so these are two like very different sides, right? The first side, the first part, you're familiar with this. Does this sound pretty familiar? The tropes in that one?
Yeah, and we were chuckling because you have to monetize everything, you know, with capitalism. So he says, you know,
comment below,
yeah,
right?
Comment
for the
below
blueprint.
But yeah, that clip's a little hard to watch. And I see come across stuff and see that kind of stuff a lot on Instagram. And but it's kind of the culture I grew up in and the stuff I'm used to hearing. And it's always presented as this is good for women. You know, this is good to have a leader. You know, you can rely on him and he's your covering and your protection and provision. It doesn't show how it disadvantages women and subordinates them. And some of the stuff that couple said, like, I agree that you shouldn't use sex to control or manipulate. That needs to go both ways, though. Like, not just she's not going to use it that way. So that's some of the problems I had with that clip.
Yeah. Do you think we're going to get to matriarchy? How
yeah, I don't know.
It feels like a long ways from where we are now to matriarchy, I'll admit. No, but there is this interesting thing happening, right, where you are having what seems like a retrenchment into these traditional gender roles, right? Like the trad. Do you know about this?
Wife.
The trad wife. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so trad wife is a trend online where you're a traditional wife. And so they really put forth this image of often living in a homestead and raising many kids and homeschooling them and baking bread and their husband, you know, coming home and them serving their husband. And there's nothing wrong with baking bread and homeschooling, you know, if that's the right educational choice for you and lifestyle choice for you. But yeah, it's definitely presented as this is the way to be a good woman and certainly a biblical woman. So yeah, there's a new generation of trad wives and especially social media influencers that are pushing purity culture. And now it's called Purity Culture 2.0, where it's kind of presented as female empowerment now. One of the big proponents of this is Maddie Pruitt Trout. She was a former Bachelor contestant, and now she is married to a megachurch youth pastor and lives in like the Dallas suburbs. And yeah, they put out this, you know, if you wait, you have this perfect life. And now they're talking about spanking their infant son. And so, yeah, it's another way to just continue that lifestyle into Gen Z.
I'm a little bit afraid. My daughter's 17, and she lives here. So I'm a little afraid. I'll be honest. I'll cut that out of the audio later. Okay, let's talk purity culture. What is it? Do you want this one, or do you want this one? Is this one better?
Yeah, I think I went over that definition.
Okay.
And, you know, many of you were greeting me before we started talking and were saying that you grew up in purity culture, too. You're familiar with it, too, even if you aren't a millennial like me. But maybe you were ones that taught it in the 1990s to 2000s. And I know that there can be regret and guilt from that. But it's never too late to change your mind and to still process these things that you used to be teachers and proponents of. So I really, really respect the people that I work with that are from the baby boomer generation and that are rethinking these things. So, but yeah, this is, yeah, my definition of purity culture. And I really focus in my book on the myths of purity culture and how it were false promises.
So let's also talk effectiveness before we get to the myths, because I remember this very distinctly because these were the Bush years in which the abstinence-only education got pushed, right? So this is 2000 to 2008. Maybe you have that on there. I don't know.
Yeah, so
those were the big years.
Abstinence-only education, yeah, was funded under the George W. Bush administration. And so even for millennials who didn't grow up in church, they may have heard these same messages in public schools. And the research showed that it was largely ineffective. The only statistic we have on effectiveness is that it tended to delay first intercourse by 18 months. But when people did become sexually active, they were less likely to use protection. So it didn't prevent teen pregnancies or STIs or some of those other things they were trying to prevent. And then purity pledges. Yeah, there's some statistics on that. But my favorite study here says that 88% of college students who took a virginity pledge had premarital sex, whereas 99% of non-pledgers did. So that means that only 12% of people who took the pledge were successful, you know, according to the study. And I like to joke that those 12% are my clients, because the majority of the clients that I see are people who got married at 20, not having premarital sex, maybe didn't even kiss before they got married. And now they're seeing me 2 decades later, still dealing with sexual problems and sexual shame and just a lot of brokenness in their marriage.
So let's go through some myths, because they were told these myths, and let's talk about them, please.
Okay. Yeah. So these 5 myths, I gave names to them based on my overview of the purity culture literature. And so the first one is the spiritual barometer myth, that you are a better Christian and your worth, identity, and value and virtue is tied up in virginity, especially for women. And these are some quotes that I pulled from purity culture books in the, as you see, the 1990s and even 2018.
Is this real, the second one? God asks us to prize our virginity and hold it up as, that's supposed to be our, I believe, right?
Oh, yes.
Hold it up as our only blood covenant?
Yes, as like an offering, yes. So I wanted to show that, like, where I got these myths from by taking these direct quotes. Because some people will say it really wasn't that bad.
It's such a strange, that one is so strange.
Yes, very strange. And that was Dana Gresh, who wrote And the Bride Wore White, and she had a whole ministry for modesty called Secret Keeper Girl, and she's still out there doing that. So
okay, fairy tale myth.
Yeah, the fairy tale myth.
This is a very common one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. This one really got to me. If you remain pure, God will bless you. You'll get a fairy tale marriage. And so when that doesn't happen for people, when I see a lot of people in their 30s and 40s who are single and who have never dated because they read I Kissed Dating Goodbye, they were told, you know, just wait and God will bring you the one, and they just don't know how to date. And who does in today's, you know, today's online dating landscape? So, so some quotes about creating a shopping list for your husband and God will give you everything that you wrote. And so I did that, and I, you know, wrote it and prayed over it, and it didn't happen. And now my husband and I joke because I had like brown hair and tan skin, and he's blonde and very fair. So
okay, flip switch. This will go, this ties in with what you were saying about some of the issue. It was called vaginismus, yes. But now it's got a longer name.
Yes.
That you said. And that's, this myth kind of speaks to that.
Yes. I was hearing people use the language of, I just thought I was going to be able to flip a switch. And so that's why I called it this. There was no sex education or preparation in purity culture. And so why do we think that that's going to come easily and naturally, you know, in marriage? Like, what comes easily and naturally? You know, everything is something that you have to work on, or a skill that you have to acquire, and something that takes teamwork and communication. And so I see, you know, clients who are really young and haven't been able to have sex in their marriage, or they don't even know that they're not having sex because they don't know anatomy and they don't know the mechanics of it. And so I'm pulling out diagrams and showing people and educating people about those kinds of things. And of course,
hold up. Yeah. Some people, let me just make sure I get this right. Some people think they're having sex and they're not.
I think, yeah. And then they're ready to have kids is when they come and see me. Yes. And so, or just women who've never had an orgasm and didn't even know that they could, or didn't even know how, you know? So But you see the quotes up here. You know, this was promised. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be a blast. It's going to be sexually fulfilling. And it's just not for the clients that I treat and for a lot of the people who grew up in this culture because of the lack of sex ed.
Gatekeeper's myth.
Yeah, this one gets into patriarchy. Mm-hmm. So this idea that women are the gatekeepers of men's sexuality, that men are more sexual and sex is for him and it's a need for him. And so women have to monitor boundaries before marriage, give sex to their husbands after marriage. And there's, yeah, lots of quotes about that. The worst one, the top one, your wife can be a methadone-like fix when your temperature is rising. So this was in every man's battle, that if you're trying to overcome pornography, your wife is methadone. And so how objectifying that is, and really placing the responsibility on her and not on the man.
Okay, one more. Mm-hmm.
And the last one, probably very recognizable, this damaged goods myth. And there were also sorts of object lessons used to convey this myth. So my book has two roses on the cover, one that's wilting and kind of crushed and dying, and one that's pristine and growing, to represent this myth, because women were compared to the dying roses, or to chewed up gum, or to cups of water with spit in them, or...
usually just the women?
It was usually just the women, it would be presented as, like, this is what you're going to be like. But then I felt like, because of the gatekeeper's myth, there was always this undertone of, like, well, we know it's going to be too hard for the men to wait, because, you know, they can't control themselves, and so it's really up to the women. So here's some quotes about your trashable styrofoam cup.
Gross. Okay, I want to do something just fun real quick. It's real quick. You're going to get a kick out of this, though, I think. I found this young woman, Alyssa Sabo. I don't know if that's how you say her name. I found her on TikTok years ago. And she sometimes reads from her old journal back from when she was like a really, really strong fundamentalist Christian, and you'll see she was obviously also in purity culture. So there's two TikToks I put back to back. Enjoy.
Christian teen journal. La, 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 la. This one is pretty intense. Trigger warning. Extremely warning. Please, God, give me a yearning for your touch. God, I want to be led by your voice and your touch. I so easily sway. Lord, may me and my boyfriend be both so enthralled by your beauty, and may we both yearn to be filled up by you, Lord. Lord, when I long for his touch, my boyfriend, and to feel his body, please restrain my fleshly and selfish desires. Surrounded by your glory, what will my heart feel when I dance for you, Jesus? Oh, you missed it. Christian Teen Journal. This one's from senior year of high school. Thank you, Lord, for the opportunity to witness to Chris. Lord, I know he's searching so much. And in a way, he's trying to seek you, but he doesn't know how. My prayer is that he has no peace and that he's unable to sleep at night. Until he allows you to come in and strip away his doubt and pride. As always, please keep using me as your willing servant, being a witness for you in my life, actions, speech, and the answers I give to his questions. Let your words come through me. I am a microphone. As the deer panteth for the water, so my soul longeth after thee.
I will say, going back to the matriarchy is inevitable thing. One of the things she said is that men don't know us. They don't watch our content, right? And she was speaking specifically of conservative men. But this has been true of me. Like, TikTok has been a huge gateway for me to discover tons and tons of amazing, funny women. And I'll just admit that I think I had a prejudice against humor with women, and I've been proven totally wrong by that, and I'm glad to be proven wrong. Okay, next. We want to get into some of the toxic issues that come up within purity culture. So I have a little combo here that I did. The first part is from, I almost said Morgan, from Camden's book. And the second part is from Sarah Longwell at The Bulwark. I did send this in a Substack, so you might have seen it there. I think I did. And I just, having read her book and then having listened to this podcast, these are former Republicans who are now never Trumpers at The Bulwark. And Sarah Longwell does, usually she does focus groups. But when I heard her and I read her book, these two things seemed too close not to put together.
Modesty culture. Modesty was a hot topic when I was in youth group. Books and ministries like Secret Keeper Girl focused on promoting high modesty standards for girls so they would not tempt boys. We were taught that our worth was on display. Our value was determined by shorts that were at least fingertip length, straps that were three fingers wide, and clothing that was loose enough to hide our curves. And don't even mention a two-piece bathing suit. Modesty culture leads to body shame and a sense that our bodies are inherently wrong, sinful, and can cause others to stumble. It makes girls responsible for boys' lust instead of empowering each sex to be responsible for their own thoughts and actions. Rape culture. Rape culture is the natural result of a modesty culture that blames women for men's actions. Rape culture is not only a part of the church, it has poisoned our secular culture as well. But many activists have astutely pointed out how purity culture can promote rape culture. In fact, research reviewing Christian dating books revealed themes supportive of rape culture, such as the teaching that women are responsible for sexual violence perpetrated by men. We hear rape culture anytime a woman is blamed, questioned, or held responsible for her sexual assault, and an offender is given a free pass. Well, what was she wearing? He's a man, he couldn't help himself. She should have known better than to be alone with him. The truth is, a victim is never responsible for their sexual assault, no matter what they wear, where they were, or whom they were with. No one is to blame but the perpetrator and the systems that are complicit in the abuse. Yet rape culture blames women and gives perpetrators, almost always men, a free pass.
You know, I just had this thought the other day that the term rape culture was like a thing that got thrown around a lot kind of during the Me Too era, where I was like, nah, you know, like it wasn't something that I just like grabbed onto, like, yes, I think this is right. But I was thinking, what is a young woman to make of a world in which a guy who was publicly talked about sexually assaulting women and that his fame allowed him to get away with it, who was constantly walking in on women at beauty pageants, who had all kinds of young women around, who divorced you know, all of his wives and slept with prostitutes and paid them off, whatever. When you elect that guy president.
Twice.
He's close friends with somebody who was at the head of the most notorious pedophile ring. He pardons Diddy, pardons Ghislaine, who was doing the recruiting for this. Like, I don't know. That's a really toxic environment for women to grow up in.
It might say a rape culture.
Yeah. I mean, this guy has been an adjudicated sexual assaulter, and people are like, that's cool. And like, yeah, just, oh, well.
I don't think those two things are unrelated, personally. I don't think we can say that the movement that is a predominantly white evangelical movement, right, which espoused purity culture and in many cases still does, it's not surprising that that same movement then is okay with these type of men as leaders. It seems surprising, right? But I think your book, and I think of course Kristen Dumais' book, sort of have shown us that this is not surprising. This is a natural progression. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, it made me think of the first clip that you showed where she was saying, you know, if you're a survivor, we see you. Because when the highest office is, you know, a man who's raped women, it's survivors feel unseen and feel not believed and feel like there's no justice or protection. I know when Dr. was Christine Ford, you know, when she testified against Kavanaugh, and, you know, they still elected him, you know, so it's just, it makes survivors not want to speak up, you know, to think I'm not going to get any justice. No one's going to believe me. Look what happened to her. So it's devastating, but yes, the gatekeeper's myth, when you say that men can't control their sexuality and then this connection to rape culture, and then you get excuses for the things that Trump has done and said. We see rape culture in the church and in our secular culture, of course. The whole Me Too movement was about this, and then the Church Too movement that came from that.
So what about courtship? This is the one that I feel like I least know about, this courtship culture one. Yeah. Although I vaguely remember there being some Christian, like Taylor, do you know Taylor University or Taylor? Okay. Some of these places around here, I would hear rumors that, like, if you went there, you couldn't go on a date with someone without a chaperone. Mm. And, you know, this was 20 some years ago when I was looking at colleges, and I was like vaguely close to purity culture, but even that for me was like, I'm sorry. You know, that was too weird. Is that what this is?
Yeah, I think courtship culture is connected to purity culture because one way to avoid premarital sex was to just not date, you know, or to have that heavily chaperoned and parent arranged process. And so I highly recommend the documentary Shiny Happy People, especially the first season that talks about the Duggars and IBLP and Bill Gothard's cult. And the Duggars practice this, and then we see their wedding on TV, and they kiss for the first time. They've never been alone. They've never held hands or, you know, been in close proximity to each other. And I think they are going to have sex tonight, or at least attempt it, and that is going to be traumatic for that young girl.
Did the kiss look ridiculous, or did it look like okay?
I think it often does, yes. But yeah, it makes me just so sad because I know the trauma that can await her, especially if he was not, you know, patient and gentle and willing to take their time. So so courtship culture is connected in that way. And then
this feels like the trad wife feels a part of this culture.
Yeah, marriage culture. So here, what I'm referring to is the idolization of marriage. Like, there's nothing wrong with being married. There's, you know, marriage can be wonderful and a great part of life. But this idolization, making it an idol, or structuring communities, and especially religious communities, around the nuclear family, around married couples. You know, when I was single, I just felt like, you know, there was not really a place for me in the church. You know, I was single through most of my 20s, didn't get married till 30, and that's old in the South. I don't know about here, but in the Southeast, and especially in evangelical Christianity, it was old. And so I just, didn't feel like I had a place, and then even more so sometimes for divorced or widowed singles. So, yeah, so this idolization of marriage is what's harmful.
Okay. I want to do one other video here, and this gives us a chance to talk a little bit about Dobson, who died, I think it was August 21, something like that, so maybe 2 weeks ago. This is Stephanie Jo Warren. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
I forgot to write it down here.
The strong-willed child.
Yep, strong-willed child. She's, like, owning that particular, which was kind of like a slur because Dobson writes this book about the strong-willed child and how you want to try and break them. And she's speaking up. She started speaking up, I think, a couple years ago, 2-3 years ago, I think she says here, and has been writing a Substack called Breaking the Stained Glass Window, I think is her Substack. And she talks about Dobson and the damage, and this is a part of the purity culture, fundamentalist Christian parenting, all that stuff. So let's hear what she has to say.
It was 2 years ago that I looked into the camera, interestingly enough, with this hat, and I said, what about Dobson? What about Dobson? When are people going to listen to the strong-willed generation, the ones that consider Dobson a third parent in their life, the one that governed what they were allowed to have in their life and what their parents would take away. He destroyed the lives of millions. And today, we all woke to the best news. But for some of us, we're bummed that he didn't get to watch his legacy be destroyed. But 2 years ago, when I made that video, I didn't know that I was going to hear from thousands of people. I didn't know that that was going to be a moment that changed my life. I didn't know that I was going to start a podcast and I was going to hear the stories of survivors. Today, when I got a text message just minutes after the news broke, it was from a fellow survivor, someone that I had the privilege of interviewing on my podcast, and he's the one that notified me. And I cannot tell you how poetic that was. See, because those that survived the strong-willed generation, those that survived Dobson, we are united together. We are determined that the voices of survivors and their stories are amplified. And we're even more determined to amplify the voices that can no longer speak. We are determined still. We are strong-willed still to dismantle the systems that he built brick by brick by brick. That generation, it is, at least with Dobson, he communicated ad nauseum how important it is to leave a lasting legacy. I want to make sure that that lasting legacy is the voices of survivors. The voices of survivors who are healing, who are mending, who are taking their power back, who are holding people accountable. He may be gone, but he can still be held accountable. And I can only hope that the voices of survivors can reach beyond. And that's the soundtrack that haunts him every single second of eternity. If you survived a wooden spoon, if you survived a metal fly swatter, if you survived a paint stirring stick, if you survived isolation, humiliation, conversion therapy, purity culture, covenant marriage, corporal punishment, authoritarian parenting, a lack of privacy, today's a good day. I celebrate with you. My name is Stephanie, and I am the strong-willed child. We have a lot more work to do. Let's get started. Oh, and I'm just wondering, now that he's gone, are you going to make a documentary?
There were so many videos to choose from on Dobson. So many people celebrating his death. So many people talking about the damage that he did. And I can remember still that voice being a voice that people took very seriously. I think in downtown Holland, we have a Focus on the Family bookstore still.
I went to it tonight.
Did you?
And I asked them to carry my book in stock.
What'd they think?
Because I looked at the shelves and I'm like, these are all outdated and they're all like toxic and horrible resources. So I'm like, my book, you know, published by Baker, which is nearby. Why don't you carry it?
So what sticks out to you? I mean, obviously she mentions purity culture, but there's so much more with Dobson.
He was a big proponent of purity culture. Focus on the Family was. And I was one that spoke out when he died of just reclaiming our voice as strong-willed children and also not grieving his loss, grieving the damage of his teachings, the lasting legacy it's left for us, and also for women who were told to stay in abusive marriages, and also those who survived conversion therapy, as she said. There's just so much damage left in the wake of his teachings and his legacy. But I think reclaiming that is empowering. And I posted about, you know, what have you been able to do because of your strong will? And I, you know, named some of the things, like writing a book, that I feel like my strong will allowed me to do. And that's a way of reclaiming it and feeling empowered by it, rather than it felt like such a shameful thing to me growing up. So it was such a stigmatized and shameful thing, that I struggled with that shame of having a strong will.
Let's look at some of these effects that you have outlined of purity culture on faith, for those who keep it, right? And then sexuality and relationships.
Yeah, well,
there are some. Listen, I was debating whether to put this positive effect slide in there. I'll be fair.
Some of these slides are drawn from, I do a clinical training for therapists, like a continuing education training. And so I have to include peer-reviewed research and, you know, have to acknowledge the positive effects that the research shows, but, you know, very little, but yeah, we can kind of skip over that. But the effects on faith, you know, even for those who don't keep their faith, the religious trauma is still, can still affect you, you know, just because you leave, you know, doesn't mean that the religious trauma has gone away. So, it can be the catalyst for deconstruction or de-identification or deconversion. And then there's the definitions of religious trauma and adverse religious experiences. So in my book, I conceptualize purity culture as a form of trauma, and I call it purity culture survivors, which was kind of controversial with my editor. You know, like, can we use the term survivor? Like, it feels too strong. And it was like, this is a term that we use. And this is a term that people will say, like, I don't feel like I survived it. I feel like I'm still surviving or trying to survive it. And so just acknowledging it as a form of trauma.
And you mentioned some of this already, yeah, but maybe just a couple of these points if you want to.
Yeah, a lot of this comes from Sheila Ray Gregoire's research. She did a study with 20,000 evangelical women and found that they have lower rates of orgasm, sexual desire, lower sexual and marital satisfaction. We talked about the rate of sexual pain is higher for Christian women. And then they have similar sexual problems as people who've experienced sexual trauma. So there's another piece of evidence to call purity culture trauma.
Just a couple more things. Effects on relationship with others and effects on relationship to self.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the inequality it just sets up because of that gatekeeper's myth that I talked about. And I see a lot of people who attribute purity culture, like, cause their divorce, you know, because they got married so young and unprepared, or they thought, I just need to marry somebody who's a Christian who's waiting, and that's it. And it's like, there's a lot more that goes into compatibility than that, and they were not prepared. And then disembodiment is a big thing that I treat, of just feeling disconnected between your mind and your body. And so that's a big focus in therapy. And that just because people leave purity culture doesn't mean that the effects leave, just like I said with religious trauma. So the myths can't be turned off just because you say, I no longer believe these, because trauma is stored in the body. And so I see a trauma response still in people's bodies, even when their minds know this isn't true.
Can I play? I'm going to play this embodiment piece that I took from your book, because I think this is so important. And it's something we touched on a couple times. It's still processing. Had a friend, her name's Bethany DeBlay. She's a trauma therapist. And she talked about the importance of embodiment. And obviously, when you talk about trauma and you talk about, is it Bessel van der Kolk? The body keeps the score, right? And I think this clip gives a really good sort of intro to the importance of some sort of integration of mind and body.
Trauma therapist and author Andy Kolber says, we cannot logic ourselves into safety or out of trauma. We need to show, don't tell. Showing our bodies, hearts, and souls the truth through our lived experience rather than just telling our minds what we should believe. We need a new understanding, true helpful beliefs, and a new experience, bodily, emotionally, and spiritually, in order to change. According to psychologist and researcher Dr. Hilary McBride, the deepest and most lasting change happens when we have new experiences and then integrate them into the larger story of our lives. Embodied experience is undeniably the most powerful channel of change.
So what are some ways that people can do embodied work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it always starts off with identifying the beliefs and identifying the effects in the person. But then, like I said, you got to make the mind change first. You got to say, you know, I realize this was a myth. It's no longer true. But then you have to have the embodied experience. So with this, I help my clients, you know, actually set up experiments where you're living out your new beliefs. So for some people, that looks like a wife being able to say no to sex for the first time in her marriage, you know, because her new belief is, I'm allowed to say no. Or that sex is for me. And so making her pleasure and her experience a priority for the first time. So just living out those new beliefs and having that new experience is what confirms the new belief for people.
So I think as we get close to where we open it up for questions. I think it'd be important to say something about, so you argue against leaving aside an ethic of shame, which is what purity culture usually produces. Mm-hmm. And one of the alternatives that is typically given to that is a sort of broad one called an ethic of consent. And this gives some definition to what that is and introduces, like, for you and for others, that this is sort of like a minimum. Mm-hmm. So let's start this.
Indeed. Enthusiastic, uncoerced consent, freely given out of each partner's agency and autonomy, is the foundation of a healthy sexual ethic. But it is not enough. The ethic of consent says that any sexual activity, as long as it is legal and agreed upon, is ethical. Many critics of the purity movement now tout the ethic of consent as an alternative to a traditional sexual ethic. Along with consent, they also espouse the values of authenticity, personal expression, freedom, and lack of self-restraint. This attitude towards sexuality has been branded sex positivity. It's not necessarily wrong, but still, it is not enough. Rethinking Sex by journalist Christine Emba analyzes how an ethic solely based on consent falls short, even from a secular perspective. Without invoking theology, Emba dismantles an ethic of consent, demonstrating that consensual sex can still be damaging to an individual, to their partner, and to society. Even consensual encounters can fail to respect the profundity that we sense sex holds, Emba explains. Consent doesn't address the gravity of what sex is or how it affects us. Consent reduces the most intimate act imaginable into little more than a legal agreement. What this ethic fails to consider is that you can objectify a person and use them for your own sexual gratification even with their consent. As Zachary Wagner bluntly states, just because it isn't rape doesn't mean it isn't dehumanizing. Examples abound of high-profile men, both in Christian culture and in Hollywood, whose actions may have been legal, but nonetheless fail to respect the feelings and dignity of their partners. In other words, consent makes sex legal, but it doesn't make it ethical. Consent is a floor, not a ceiling.
So let's talk a little bit about what you suggest people do, which is building their own sexual ethic that aligns with their values, whatever those might be, a values-congruent sexual ethic.
Yeah, so values congruent is a term from dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, the type of therapy that I practice, which just talks about having alignment between your behavior and your values. Because when you don't, you have cognitive dissonance. And so you're probably familiar with that term. You know, when our beliefs and our behavior don't line up, we experience distress and dissonance. And so in order to resolve that cognitive dissonance and the guilt that we feel, we have to align our behavior with our values. And so I really challenge people to develop a values congruent sexual ethic, leaving it open to the person to select what their values and beliefs are. And so that's why I push back against this ethic of consent, because I just think it's not enough. It's not getting at people's values. There's more than just, like Christine Emba says, it's a floor, not a ceiling. There's more to consider when it comes to one's sexual ethic. And so that is kind of controversial to push back against that, because that is offered as the alternative by a lot of purity culture critics. But I just feel as a psychologist, you know, that shame and guilt that people feel is not resolved by just, you know, throwing away the ethic of shame and doing its opposite. You know, it's really resolved by living out your values, and you first have to figure out what those values are. So.
Okay, I'm going to end with one last thing, and then I'm going to open it up for questions. And this is called Wise Mind. I've come across this a few other places before, and I've always liked it when I've heard it. So I don't think I've offered it to the still processing folks before. So check this out, and then I'm going to open it up. Well, I'll let you say a few things about Wise Mind after that, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Wise Mind. The concept of wise mind can ground us when we are emotionally dysregulated and help us make decisions and act from a place of centeredness and wisdom. Fundamentalism squashes our ability to listen and look inside ourselves. This exercise allows us to grow self-trust. Emotion mind is the part of our mind that is hot when we are ruled by our moods, feelings, urges, impulses, and desires. Reasonable mind, sometimes called rational mind, is cool when we are ruled by facts, logic, rational thinking, and analysis. The goal is not to swing from the extreme of emotion mind to the extreme of reasonable mind. It is not effective to be either or. Instead, we seek the dialectic or integration of the two. This is wise mind, The wisdom deep within each person, our intuition and gut, a felt sense of knowing that brings together both emotions and logic.
So I think for me, I mean, I definitely grew up thinking I was just going to use my rational mind. And then, of course, doing lots of schooling, getting advanced degrees, that was all that was being formed in me was my brain, right? And I've had to learn a lot about being in touch with my emotions and then also realizing, and we did some work on this, it's still processing. There's a woman named Lisa Feldman Barrett. I don't know if that's a name you know. She has a new theory on emotions, which is their information about the world. Like, just as the stuff I'm used to, like, hearing and reading as information, my emotions are information about the world around me, right? And both of them together is how you get wise mind, right?
Yeah, so this is another tool from dialectical behavior therapy, and dialectical means integration of two seemingly opposing ideas. And so it's this both-and perspective instead of either-or. So with wise mind, it's presented as a Venn diagram. If you remember that from high school geometry, or I don't know when they teach that. But you've got rational or reasonable mind on one side, which is logic, and then you've got emotion mind on the other side, which is your desires, impulses, any feelings. And, you know, often people think that side is bad, especially if you grew up in, you know, fundamentalist religion. Like, the heart is wicked and deceitful. Emotions are bad and misguided. You can't trust yourself. You need to look outside yourself to authority and experts to tell you what to do.
Yeah, your intuition is...
There is none.
Yeah.
You know, you're taught to distrust it and not hear it. And so people lose their being in touch with that and lose that self-trust. And so I include this skill at the end of the chapter on reconstructing your sexual ethics so that people can get practice in going inside and thinking about their wise mind, bringing in those emotions, bringing in the logic, and thinking, you know, inside, what is their intuition and that deep sense of knowing inside of you say? And that's very scary for some people to look inside instead of looking outside of themselves. But I said, that's the last thing you need is another expert to tell you what to do. Try to be very careful about that in my book. You don't need another expert to tell you what to believe or what to think or what to do. You have to figure it out for yourself. And I wanted to give people the skills to do that. So wise mind is one that can help.
Excellent. Questions? I will come to you if you have one.
Hi, this is my first time here. My name is Karen. I'm also a therapist. But work, it's irrelevant. I'm just curious, I think, about how the absence or the breakdown of the dating system and the courtship thing that used to be and the online apps, you know, finding partners that way, How has the research shown that to reflect on positively, negatively on what goes on in the therapy room for you?
Well, I'm not familiar with any research on that topic, but I can just tell you anecdotally from what I see that people, yeah, have a hard time knowing how to date. But I don't know that that's exclusive to just people who grew up in courtship or purity culture. I think it's just... the landscape's just really difficult right now for everyone, but it leaves people feeling really confused. You know, there's no roadmap when you're in your 30s or 40s or beyond for how to date, because purity culture promised us we were all going to get married young to our first love. So there was no imagination for what that could look like. And then when you throw away those rules, again, like, what is in its place? And so that's often very challenging for people who are single to try to figure out how they want to navigate that, especially if they do want a partner or marriage.
There's also, I think that video of, you know, the couple that are in this headship, whatever, what do we used to call that? Not egalitarians, the better one. Complementarianism. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'd be happy to never remember that word again, to be honest. That there is like this growing gap, right? between men and women. Women are really succeeding educationally, succeeding in many, many ways, growing more independent. And men are really struggling to deal with this new landscape. And so you're seeing some of this like, well, let's go back to the old model when we were just kind of able to decide and y'all didn't have any independence. And I hope that fails miserably.
Well, there's also a growing gap of, you know, there is research that women are leaving the church more and leaving religion more. Men are becoming more politically conservative and women aren't. And, you know, so that leaves less compatible partners for women, too. They're not able to find a partner that they're aligned with, maybe spiritually or politically.
That's right. Anybody else? Question?
Have you done anything with Elizabeth Elliot and her brand of purity?
Yeah, there's all kinds of problems from Elizabeth Elliot and her teachings and her life. And and she wrote Passion and Purity, so she was one of the early proponents of purity culture. And this model of, look how I did it, and it turned out well for me, so that's the blueprint for everybody. Another problem I find with her is this glorification of suffering and martyrdom. And I think there's just a lot of, like, things being hard is good. And you know, that translates to people saying, well, my marriage is really hard, when it's really abusive, but they think it's hard, and so that's good, and I need to stay and keep working at it because I need to be a martyr and I need to do the hard thing. So when really it's abusive and they need to leave, or unhealthy and they need to leave. So yeah, so there's many different problems with, I think, Elizabeth Elliot's work beyond purity culture even. Mm-hmm.
This is just a comment to piggyback on what she just said, or and what you said about Elizabeth. It turns out all three of her husbands were abusive. So,
hi, I'm Laura. First time, second time. Anyway, if you want to learn more about courtship and how the effects of that on marriage, I have a friend of mine that was in a forced marriage. She has a documentary called Knots, the documentary. So that's a good one to look up. I personally have been wondering, how has your book been received? How are you feeling like people are responding to your book?
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you for that question. I think the response has been mostly positive. My favorite, you know, people to hear from is obviously other purity culture survivors who have used this book in their healing and taken it to therapy and told their therapist about it and worked through the exercises and really made it a part of their healing. And so that's always gratifying to hear. And then, as I said, I've done clinical trainings for therapists. And so getting to speak to my profession is a pleasure, and you know, getting to educate them about this topic, because it's not something that every therapist is going to know about, or they might have some personal experience with, but they don't know how to deal with it professionally. So that's also been a good opportunity. But sometimes I'm too conservative for some groups and too progressive for others, and so sometimes I get pushback, like from purity culture critics, you know, will say, because I am still a Christian and writing in the book primarily to Christians. They might not like that perspective, but then more conservative groups don't like that I criticize patriarchy and things like that. So when you are a both and person, I find that you get criticism from both sides. And so I think that that is a sign that I'm doing what I set out to do. And what my mission is to walk the middle path. That's a DBT term. So I just have to get comfortable with criticism from both sides and know that there's a lot more people that need to hear that middle path perspective too.
My name is Daniel. Thank you. I'm someone who grew up with and survived that. And to my great shame, I think I also taught it when I was a pastor briefly and working with youth. As someone who's been deeply formed by that, going through the process of deconstruction of that sexual ethic, I'm curious if you can say a little bit more about what you said at the end there. Is the critique of the modern sexual ethic quantifiable? It sounded like what I heard you saying was, well, there's something mysterious about sex, and therefore we should give it a greater sense than this new sexual ethic does. Is there, can we say any more about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think some of that came, those are quotes from Christine Emba's book about the profundity sex holds, is a quote from her. But yeah, what I'm really challenging people to do is look at their values beyond just it's consensual and it's legal. And so look at values like respect for yourself and for others and how you want to treat other people. Look at values like safety. Look at values like mutuality in the experience. And so I think there's more to it from a faith perspective and a spiritual perspective for me, but there's also more to it just from a values perspective that I think I would challenge anyone to look at.
I pulled, so she, if you want to read a little bit of what Christine Emba has to say, this is from a secular perspective, that there's an article in the Washington Post, and she also has a book, right? And I just pulled sort of like her base level advice, which was willing the good of the other in a sexual encounter is what she suggests as sort of a mantra. So she says, willing the good means caring enough about the about another person to consider how your actions and their consequences might affect them, and then choosing not to act if the outcome would be negative. It's mutual concern, thinking about someone other than yourself, and then working so their experience is as good as you hope yours to be. It's taking responsibility for navigating interactions that might seem ambiguous, rather than using the ambiguity to excuse self-serving misunderstandings.
Yeah, so even the term enthusiastic consent, some people use that. That's adding a value to the consent-only ethic. It's adding this value of enthusiasm. But yeah, Emba says willing the good of the other is her sexual ethic, and what she is proposing is to move away from, you know, more of the individualistic culture of just my experience, more towards the collectivistic view of what the other person's experience is too. And she also talks a lot about in her book about how consent-only sex disadvantages women because women have more at stake in sexual encounters, you know, just biologically. And then also being, you know, in the lesser power position or being more vulnerable to sexual abuse and things like that. So she takes a feminist perspective too.
And the orgasm statistics would tell you that men need to be willing the good of the other more than the other way around.
Hi, I'm Jen.
Hi, Jen.
I was raised in purity culture and now I'm raising kids. Do you have any good resources for how we don't do that to our kids, but we don't go the other way either?
Yeah. The last chapter of my book is called Parenting After Purity Culture that attempts to kind of start the conversation on that. But so far, there aren't really any good resources that I can wholeheartedly recommend. There's good ones on general sex ed for kids. And so that's helpful and just kind of understanding their sexual development and what's normal at each age and stage. And that's helpful. But there's not a lot of great resources yet, I think, on helping kids develop their sexual ethic. So in that chapter, I mostly focus on values like critical thinking that I want to pass on to my kids, being empowered, respect for self and others. Like those are values that transcend any particular sexual ethic that I want them to have. Especially that critical and nuanced thinking, because that's something that was really missing in purity culture, I think. And then there's like general tips and, you know, like making sex education lifelong rather than a one and done sex talk and things like that. But really, I think it's looking at how can you teach them the skills so that they can develop their own sexual ethic rather than handing them yours or handing one to them.
And I think I recall you saying instead of having like one sex talk,
yeah,
try to weave talk about sex into as many normal conversations as you possibly can, which, of course, normalizes talking about sex, but also gives you more opportunities to give advice and thoughts, right? So I thought that was excellent as well, and that occurred to me. Anybody else? We have time for one more, two more maybe?
I just wondered if you had a comment about how families are being fractured as kids are coming up and they're realizing my parents raised me in this worldview and the parents have regret and the kids have wounds, I know I have to sometimes witness the pain of my child and have regret. And I'm learning to hold space for that. But I wonder how you navigate that with families. Do you sit with mothers and daughters and their children and help them navigate that conversation?
Yes, I am so intrigued by this topic right now because one of the unanticipated consequences we're seeing of Dobson's form of parenting is that there are higher rates of estrangement right now between, you know, my generation and their parents. So higher rates of those fractured relationships or no contact. And that's devastating, you know, as a I have young kids, you know, but as a parent, I know that would be devastating. And yet the adult kids are feeling so much pain, and often the parents aren't willing to listen and hold space. So thank you for you doing that with your children. But yeah, I think the adult children just want their pain to be witnessed and to be listened to and understood and validated. And I know that as a parent, it's hard to admit when you've made mistakes, and you know, we pour so much of ourselves into parenting and into our children. So to hear "you hurt me" when that's our last intention is so painful. And so I know, you know, when that day comes with my kids and they have to go to therapy because of me, you know, like that's going to be hard and painful to hear. But yet the humility that you're modeling for your kids and going back to that like lifelong learning and you're never too old to change that I said earlier, you're never too old to grow. If you can model that for your kids, it will help them in their healing process. For them, for you to say, I know I taught you purity culture. I really thought that was the best thing at the time, yet I know it hurt you and I know it was wrong and I wish I had not done that or had done something different. And, you know, I want to hear how you feel about it, how it affected you, and what you wish I had done differently too. And like just to have that open conversation with humility would go so far, because I think in the cases that I see of estrangement, the parent is not willing to do that. Now, sometimes it is the adult child who does not have the skills yet to know how to have that conversation. And so they just cut off their parents or they just minimize contact. But often it is the parent not being willing or able to sit with the discomfort of that conversation.
There's a book I really like that I recommend on parenting. It's The Gardener and the Carpenter or The Carpenter and the Gardener. Do you know this one? I can't remember the name of the person who did it. Mm-hmm. It's really great. It's advocating for a perspective of gardening, yeah. Meaning you create a space for things to grow as opposed to the carpenter who's trying to make something very specific. Right out of their child. And you said something like this in your book, a relationship, I think, relationship-oriented parenting over authoritarian parenting, maybe?
Yeah, using the term connected parenting rather than authoritarian or control-based parenting. And so that requires that humility and valuing the connection with your child above being right.
Good stuff. So I was curious about, you know, some of the things that both of you have talked about tonight about messages we hear, and I think I've become more aware of how difficult it is to talk about sex openly and honestly in our culture. Partly because of purity culture, but also because of other really strong and pervasive messages that when you start hearing them when you're young and uninformed and you're still learning, they must be true, right? And I read a book a few years ago called Come As You Are. I don't know if anybody's ever read that. But even when I was planning to bring that up, I thought, can I say the title of this book? Like, how are people going to respond to Come As You Are when we're talking about this stuff? And it just signals to me how afraid we are to talk about sex, how afraid we are to say words like orgasm and to share data about, you know, women around orgasming. Do you have thoughts on how we can have more healthy and open discussions and shift cultural norms around sex, including how our bodies respond and what we've maybe been told is true about whether we want sex or don't want sex based on how our body responds to something?
Mm-hmm.
I think that comes back to making sex education lifelong and having those ongoing conversations like Josh mentioned earlier with kids, so that you're talking about bodies and sex in a shame-free way, in an open way, in a matter-of-fact way, just like you would talk about any other body part or bodily function or things like that. But yeah, doing this work does require me to say things in public and talk about things on social media that I never imagined I would do. And yet I tell my sex therapy clients there's no such thing as TMI in sex therapy. So you feel free to tell me anything you need to. And sometimes that's why people are coming, is because they don't even know how to talk to their spouse about what feels good. And so they need help with the language to do that. So I think the more we can talk about it in shame-free and matter-of-fact ways, the more normalized it becomes.
That's good. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks for helping to facilitate this fantastic conversation. Josh, we hope that you all enjoyed the evening tonight, or even if you didn't enjoy it, even if you were like, oh, some of this stuff was hard to talk about, hard to listen to, hard to think about, hard to unpack. We're glad that you're here, and we hope that you felt some tension and that you're walking away asking questions and thinking about your own experiences and what you want to learn and grow from tonight. Our next guest here at Still Processing is Anita Sanchez. She is the author of Four Sacred Gifts, Indigenous Wisdom for Modern Times. Has anybody read this book in here? No? It's supposed to be fantastic. She writes in this book, "We open ourselves to a more holistic orientation than restrictive worldviews that have led us into inner and outer crisis. And that reemergence of belonging occurs when we know who we are and when we can be in right relationship with ourselves, with other people, and with the planet." So make sure you come and check that out. Is it up here? What's the date again? October 2. So be here. We hope to see you. And if you want to stick around and ask questions, I think usually our speakers are still here for a little bit. And she's got books back there as well. So thanks again for being here.